I carry a cap in my glove box, but getting it out on the roadway would be a little dangerous.
I believe you're correct, Bernie. Okay, sounds like we got a way to get there. And it's on that FCC.gov, wireless.fcc.gov, is that what you said, Bernie? Go ahead.
US land for a comment.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, if you look at his OLA license, the DFR number is written, it's posted up right on that license. If he still got the, unless he lost that one, I don't know.
So what I think you're saying, Paul, is that we all receive a large sheet of our license plus the small foldable wallet-sized one. And I think you're saying in the last 10 years, if you renewed, your FRN number is there. Is that it, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, you should have it if it's within, you know, I'm, mine is 2007, so I'm up to 9 years and I have it.
I just went to the website. It gets you straight to the page that I was talking about. So, what did you use as a search word to get to the right website, Eric? Go ahead. I didn't. I just went directly to wireless.fcc.gov. And then you typed in your call letter, so to speak? I'm still looking for that part. Okay. As you look for that, we're going to go over to the mailbag. John, Casey.
D2OSO, I've got his number.
Go ahead, Bob.
I just went into the FCC database and I looked up Rich's FRN number. I don't want to give it over the air, but if I can get his email address, I'll send it to him.
Rich, is your email address published on QSZ.com? Over to you, Rich.
Yes, it is, Dick. It certainly is. And Bob, thank you. Go back to net. Bob, you're very nice to me. Thank you. What kind of thing?
You can get there directly yourself, which is not that hard. On the right-hand side, you'll find a line that says FRN number. Click on it, and then you go to the part that says search and put in your call sign.
All right, thank you. But Bob has it already. Bob emailed it to me. And Eric, thank you.
And I see that on the Limoc roster, N2EO, his email address is there. See, I guess it's Bernie that asked that question. So on the Limoc roster, N2EO, doesn't have a phone number, but it does have his email address.
I got everything, Dick. I'll send it to him right now.
Very fine, Bob. Okay, it's time for the mailbag. KC2WGB. What kind of deep questions have we received from those college students that are doing their homework with us? Occasionally that happens. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2IW and the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Yeah, they're busy, that's for sure. Got an interesting question here from a classic car holder who has a question about an antenna. Let me let it drop and I'll go on with this. Okay, this young man has a classic 32 Ford Deuce Coupe and it's entirely fiberglass, no metal. So his question is, he really would not want to put a half-wave antenna on a structure like this. He tried someone's suggestion as two quarter-wave whips hooked up on either end of the coax cable. That did not work out at all. He had a lot of trouble with that. But his question is, if he wanted to use a quarter-inch, a quarter-wave whip on the rear deck, if he enclosed the entire interior of the trunk area where the rumble seat is and all with foil, aluminum foil, would that give him a counterpoise? Because with all fiberglass, he really has problem there. What is your suggestion, Dick? Or do you think that's a waste of time and you should just go with a half wave and get it over with? Back to you, Dick. KC2 WGB.
Yeah, the biggest variable, and the question you're asking, John, is what the heck frequency he's on. If he wants to be on 160 meters, or if he wants to be on 450, then...
2 meters.
Okay, so it's on 2 meters. From what you know, he's willing to put a 2 meter antenna on the vehicle. Does he give us a maximum length of whip that he's willing to put on? A 36-inch whip would be a half wavelength long. He wouldn't need any counterpoise at all. He's feeding it from the outer edge. And he's going to have to put an impedance matching network because he's feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance instead of a 35 ohm impedance, which is what a quarter wave whip would be with an extremely good ground plane. You've also got a metal frame to the car. Even though the car is fiberglass, there's a metal frame, I am guessing, and there's also metal going to the bumper. That's also useful. So what do we know along those lines before we proceed? Over to you, John, KC2, WGB, K2IW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, he has an independent chassis, but that is box-beam fiberglass also. The entire car is fiberglass, except for areas that support, like, you know, the shock absorbers and springs, things like that, the landing zones, but no large area of metal at all, hardly. Rails.
Somebody had something, but all we heard was rails. Who said that, and what was it?
The glass rails.
That was K2YO. I was hoping maybe he had metal frame rails, but John's saying that they're fiberglass also. So he does not have a lot of metal anywhere.
Yeah, from my point of view, to get an efficient antenna in that environment, the antenna is going to have to be electronically a half wavelength long. Whether he decides to feed that half wavelength dipole in the center or the edge, outer edge, is his choice. My preferred technique would be to feed the outer edge. There are commercially made 2 meter antennas, mag mount like antennas, which are advertised to be electronically a half wavelength, which means that the base of the mag mount is feeding the outer edge of the half wave electronic radiator. It's feeding the 1,500 ohm impedance. Therefore, the impedance matching network is already there. Homebrewing that is not a big deal. But just go out and buy the commercial product, the mag mount half wave, and even though it is a mag mount, and you're about to ask now, how in the world do I mount it to the car? Well, you put a small piece of metal that is magnetically operated, mount that on the car somewhere that the mag mount will stick to. We'll find some other way of screwing the mag mount down to the fiberglass. But the magic of a half wavelength radiator fed from the outer edge, let me drop. The magic is that when you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance, you don't need a ground plane. The coax cable is close enough to a counterpoise. The shield on the coax cable, if you know what I mean. And you'll have a tiny bit of RF in the shack. But if that RF is coming from a 1,500 ohm antenna as a reflecting object, as opposed to a 35 ohm antenna, if it was a quarter wave whip, huge difference. Orders of magnitude less RF in the shack, so to speak. So he can get 95% efficiency out of a half wave resonator, half wave radiator. Now, the half wave radiator doesn't necessarily have to be exactly mechanically a half wavelength long. It's only got to be electronically a half wavelength long. Half wavelength long on 2 meters is around 38 inches or so, 37 inches long. And if you don't want to have a whip 37 inches long, and you want it half that distance, half that length, there's all kinds of ways. Let me drop. There's all kinds of ways you can electronically squeeze that down to be mechanically smaller by a loading coil in the center and top hat capacitors on the ends and so on. So the elegant solution is a 38-inch long whip fed from the outer edge. and if you really have to, there's lots of ways of squeezing that down. But there's a commercial product that does what he wants, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
K2YO.
Go ahead, Bernie. Wait for the beeps.
I think that answer is missing a point here. This is a 32 Ford coupe. This is not a common car. This is a highly specialized, it's a show car. And so pop ribboning a plate to put a mag mounted on it is entirely not an option. If he were to go with a quarter wave, how big of a ground plane would he need to build underneath the fiberglass to make it functional?
I don't recommend you go there, Bernie. In the case of an automobile which has got a metal roof, that whole great big chunk of metal on the roof is big enough, but you don't want to do that, if you know what I mean. But as long as you go over to a half-wave antenna, you don't need a counterpoise at all. The shield of the coax cable is more than enough counterpoise, because when you're feeding a 1,500-ohm impedance antenna, because you're feeding the outer edge of a half-wave, that is, let me think of the number now, 220, it's 30 times higher in impedance than a quarter wave. When that impedance is so high, you don't need a counterpoise anymore. The shield of the coax is more than enough. All he's got to do is find some mechanical way of mounting the so-called mag mount to his car, and it doesn't necessarily have to be mounted to a sheet of metal. He could take that mag mount and glue it to the fiberglass, if you know what I mean. It would work. K2IO for any comments. K2IW, go ahead, Bernie.
Comment.
Something just came to mind. John, I think you're more cognizant of what a 32 Ford coupe looks like. I just thought of something. What if they put a ball mount on it, like the old HF antennas used, and then run like a two-wave antenna or something, something that might be more classic to what that car originally would have. Just a thought. K2YO.
Good suggestion, Bernie. I think Dick has already answered this gentleman's problem because, like you said, it's a show car, very expensive paint job. He could glue a hunk of steel under that rear deck, which that magnet on a good quality mag mount will adhere to that fiberglass through that magnetic coupling will take place. And it doesn't have to provide any of the RF characteristics. It's a half-wave antenna. When he goes to a show, he just lifts the antenna off, problem solved. He could have a half wave, it wouldn't matter how far it's sticking up. And when he's, you know, if he's going to put it on display anywhere, just pop the antenna off. I think that's a great idea. You guys solved it. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I'm glad the Eastern input has come back.
Dennis is trying again.
Yeah, as we passed it over to Bernie, somebody else came in, and the beeps didn't get a chance to reset, and so portions of Bernie's transmission didn't go through the Eastern input. Who's the other person that wants to talk to us? K2LIW, wait for the beeps.
And K2CJE.
K2GJE, K2LIW, go right ahead.
Comment, what about bolting a J-pole to the rear bumper and you can take it off while the show is over?
Yeah, that's another workable solution. Yep. A J-pole antenna doesn't need a counterpoise. It has it already built into the antenna, so to speak. And in fact, a J-pole is a kind of half-wave antenna. That's how it does its thing. The actual radiator on a J-pole is electronically a half-wave. KC2WGB, K2IW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, I believe we've provided some options for his problem. I think all of them are workable. Yeah, J. Paul, maybe he doesn't want to attach anything. Even the bumper, by the way, is plastic. Well, fiberglass, whatever they call that stuff. It has some a little bit of chrome applique, but it's not a piece of metal in the car, hardly, except for the engine. So, yeah, good job, guys. I think he's got a lot of information to go by. All right, let me let her drop. I'll go on to my next one.
I'll send you the bill.
Is that for you, Dick?
I think that could have been Ed, K2TJE, who said he's going to send us the bill. Go right ahead with the next one, John. KC2WGB, after the beep, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, all right. We take any bills. We don't care. All right. Now, this young man has an interesting question. And with your working with so much aircraft and electronics, you might have an answer for this gentleman. He would like to know, why do they still use air pressure indication for altitude? Electronics works well. It might be erratic reading because of ground terrain, but why do they use air pressure for indication of altitude in this day and age, Dick? If you know, maybe there's a reason why the electronics is not as well, but I'll turn it back to you, sir, for an answer. KC2WGB.
My first guess is it's one hell of a tradition. In other words, from the early days of heavier than air, or even lighter than air, from the earliest days of aircraft, there is this very well-documented air pressure versus altitude characteristic. So an aneroid barometer, that's what it really is. An altitude indicator really is a barometer. And it's an extremely reliable thing that if your battery fails, if your generator fails, your alternator fails, your wiring fails, all of these things will take any kind of electronic altitude indicator and throw it out the window. But that barometer-like altitude indicator, it's going to keep on cranking. And altitude is a very important thing, particularly if you're in a fog. If you know you're flying over a piece of terrain that's got a mountain that's 2,000 feet high, you know darn well in that fog, you better be above 2,000 feet, otherwise there's a good possibility you're going to be flying below the level of the local terrain, and you're going to be unhappy. Let me drop. So no matter how sophisticated the electronics is on my airplane, as a pilot, and I'm not much of a pilot. Yes, I've soloed, but I don't have very much non-solo, beyond solo time. But still, everything I know about piloting tells me I would want a real barometer-type altitude indicator on that instrument panel. RPM, altitude, and airspeed are very important parameters. The next thing beyond that would be artificial horizon, so that I want to know the orientation of the plane. I want to know how fast the air is moving over that wing. I want to know what direction I'm aimed. I want to know how high I am. As many of those controls as can be non-electronic and highly reliable, that's what I, as a pilot, would demand. The ball bank indicator requires no electronics. The RPM indicator requires no electronics. Airspeed indicator, no electronics. Altitude indicator, no electronics. Traditional reasons they were done that way, and no matter how sophisticated my electronics is, I'd want those backup controls on that panel, because my goodness, you'd be amazed how many times in a difficult situation your electronics goes down the tubes and you got nothing. That's an opinion. I'm going to pass it over to John. We're going to drag our feet, because other pilots out there want to give us more indication of their feelings on this subject. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, the reason he asked the question is he realizes that you set your altimeter when you're leaving. The information is gained over the radio from the controller. And when you take off, even if you turn around immediately and come back to land, that pressure could have changed. your altimeter is wrong. So that's why he was wondering why it's not basically all electronic. But, yeah, I see your point. It's been since the days of air balloons. Very good. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my last one.
Yeah, I'm going to add some more words to this.
Right ahead.
If you're taking off from Denver Airport and somebody didn't tell you the real altitude of that airport and you didn't set it correctly, you're going to end up with some error. And when you do set that altitude indicator on your altitude machine, yes, the possibility exists that the air pressure where you're taking off from and the local air pressure where you land could be different. But rarely does that difference in air pressure make more than 100, 150 foot of altitude difference, rarely. So I think you can trust a aneroid altitude indicator to the nearest 150 feet. I'm going to pick a number. Yes, it's going to develop 100, maybe 200 feet of error in worst case. But if you're doing a proper approach to an airport, during that final leg, you're down to 600 feet above the altitude. And if because of the error in your altimeter, you're really at 400 versus 600, or you're at 800 versus 600, rarely is that a problem, particularly if you're on visual flight rules and you can see that runway. And if you're flying IFR, you still can't land on that runway before your eye sees it. We've all dreamed about completely blind. Let me drop. We've all dreamed about instrument flight rule, completely blind landings by way of global positioning satellite receivers, other kinds of electronics. Sounds good. There's a very rare pilot who will feel comfortable coming down to a runway that his eye does not see that runway when he's down to the last couple of hundred feet above that runway. If his eye is not seeing that runway, his chances of making that landing are very poor. He's going to be waved off and go to some other place. And so the changes in air pressure doesn't make that big a difference if you're doing conservative flying. So don't worry about the air pressure changes giving you error. The error is not that big, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, all right, I understand that, and sounds acceptable. It's just that we've been doing that for so long, and nobody has found a better system, and it is a very simple system, and very seldom do they have trouble with it. By the way, somebody just sent in a quick little message here in the chat room about the automobile, the 32 Deuce, that maybe he should add some metallic pinstriping on the car to give him a ground plane. A cool idea. All right, let me really drop. I'll go on my last one. Alrighty, this young gentleman has been reading about pin diodes, and he would like to know what makes them special, what applications are they used in, and basically a general history of them, if you could, in a quick fashion. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
If I was running a 50-watt transmitter, I just chosen that number because on a 50-ohm line, since power is I squared R, and I want 50 watts, I know that the RMS current on that 50-ohm cable is going to be one RMS ampere, when I'm running 50 watts, which, by the way, is going to be 1.414 times 50. It's going to be around 70. 50, did I say 50 amperes? No, 1 ampere. Yeah. It's going to be around 1.414 peak amperes. So if I took a fairly Stucci RF diode and I forward bias it at 1.5 amperes and I put it in series with my coax cable on the output of my transmitter and I've got the right kind of an RF choke, I'm putting 1.5 amperes of forward bias current on my fairly Stucci diode. It's in series with the semiconductor of the coax cable and it's connected to the transmitter. That 50 watts will flow through there with a fraction of a watt of loss, and that's a pretty good switch. And when I don't forward bias that diode, if I reverse bias it by a good number of volts, the diode becomes an open circuit. So I've now made an electronic switch. I've made an electronic transmit-receive relay, so to speak, out of a simple, fairly stoochy RF diode with 1.5 amperes of forward bias. The reason I chose 1.5 amperes is that the peak forward current and the peak reverse current when I'm running 50 watts is a little bit shy of 1.5 amps. I want to make sure the diode always stays forward biased throughout the complete RF cycle coming out of the transmitter going into that coax cable. Let me drop. That's the brute force approach. And now when I run a kilowatt, obviously I've got to put a lot more current into that diode, quite a few amperes. And it's now getting a little bit difficult to find a diode that can take that much current without developing a lot of heat. The magic of a pin diode is that the diode, that the original diode I'm talking to you about, made for RF service, and if I'm doing it at, let me pick a number, 30 megacycles, that diode is a good rectifier at 30 megacycles. So if I was only biasing it at half an ampere, during a portion of that RF cycle, the diode would become an open circuit, and I'd be transmitting a non-sinusoidal wave, so that portions of that RF cycle, the diode's an open circuit, so the transmitter would not be continuously connected to the coax cable throughout the complete RF cycle at, say, 30 megahertz, in my example. Let me drop. Somebody realized that you got to do some special things to make a diode fast enough to operate at 30 megs or 100 megs. You got to do some special things to make the diode fast enough. In the early days, solid-state diodes were pretty slow. They were way fast enough in order to operate as a 60-cycle or a 400-cycle rectifier for a power supply. But for RF purposes, it was a number of years downrange before solid-state diodes were fast enough to do a good job at RF frequencies. I don't think it was until roughly 1960 you had good RF diodes. Let me drop. I think it was somewhere in the 1960s somebody realized that if you took a diode that is very slow in operation, you intentionally made a sloppy diode. PIN stands for positive intrinsic negative. You know that when you're making a solid-state diode, you've got one end of the diode that's doped with positive material, and the other end of the diode is doped with negative material, and the junction between the two, you try to make that junction as small as possible in order to have very little transit time to have a high-frequency diode. Somebody came to the conclusion, what happens if we do it the opposite way? If we intentionally make a thick layer of ordinary silicon halfway in between the negative end of the diode and the positive end of the diode, we've got this intrinsic region, got a region that has no doping in there at all. You start trying to use that diode as a rectifier, and you find out it's extremely slow in operation. At first, it sounds very undesirable. If you can choose a diode that's slow enough, and you forward bias it, you only need a couple of milliamps of forward bias to turn the diode on. If you wait that couple of milliseconds until the diode turns on, and now it's in the on mode, but it doesn't see the full RF cycle. The 1.5 amperes of positive and negative peak current of my example, the 50 watt transmitter, the diode is so slow, it doesn't see that at all. During the negative sine wave, it doesn't get a chance to stop conducting because of the few milliamps of forward bias current you put into it. So the idea of the pin diode is it requires very little bias current because it's so slow, it doesn't see the RF, and yet you still have the on-off function that you desire. That's the good news. The bad news, let me drop. The bad news is that in order to use a pin diode as a solid-state transmit-receive switch, you have to find diodes that are slow enough for your particular frequency. To find a diode that will act as a pin diode at 1 gigahertz is easy. To find a diode that works at 100 megahertz is starting to get hard. You try to find diodes that do a good job at, say, 14 megahertz and 7 megahertz. There are very few of those that you can buy that are that slow. And therefore, you might be halfway between a pin diode and a regular diode, where you now have to use a larger amount of forward current. when you're in the conducting mode in order to properly turn that diode on. So the only problem is that modern day diodes, I think it's difficult to find ones that are slow enough. Yes, many of the rigs that we can buy these days, many of those solid-state rigs have solid-state transmit-receive switching networks made out of diodes. And now your next question is, if that rig goes down to 80 meters or 160 meters, is that really a pin diode? The answer might be no. If you study the circuit hard enough, you may discover that the solid-state switching circuit in your 160-meter modern-day 100-watt rig, they may be using a rather large amount of bias current on those diodes because you can't make pin diodes slow enough to operate down at 1.8 megahertz. So it takes some extra testing. What would happen if the diode starts becoming an open circuit during a portion of the RF cycle? It would be that, by definition, making a non-sinusoidal waveform coupled to your antenna. Let me drop. And whenever that waveform is anything but a beautiful, pure, symmetric, nice, clean, sine wave, anything different than that, that you can see on an oscilloscope, means you're generating harmonics, and probably, if you're putting out more than one frequency at once, like a single sideband signal is, you're probably generating intermodulation distortion. So, you got to be kind of careful with solid-state switching diodes. You got to make double darn sure that the diode stays in the full conducting mode during the full RF cycle of the highest power you intend to run, the peak envelope power. So, and when it comes to making fast diodes, if you go in the opposite direction, if you make a diode that you can forward bias and put a whole lot of stored energy into the diode's junction region, and then you back bias the diode, and that energy you put in there slowly drains away and then abruptly comes to an end at the end of the negative cycle, so to speak, that's called a snap-action diode or a step recovery diode. That diode, by definition, makes a huge amount of very strong harmonics. And if you're building an intentional frequency multiplier, let me drop it. That snap action of the diode is very desirable if you're building a harmonic generator. That the step recovery diode can take your 100 megahertz signal, for instance, and generate a whole lot of combs every 100 megacycles up the band, and you put the right kind of a cavity filter that favors the 1 gigahertz comb line, you've now got a beautiful 10-to-1 frequency multiplier. And properly set up with the right kind of idling circuits, a step recovery diode could allow you to multiply a 100 meg oscillator to a 1 gigahertz oscillator, and you might be able to do that with 25 or 30% efficiency. By ordinary techniques, to make a 10th harmonic out of a sine wave, and to do that with 20 or 30% efficiency, that's a very good trick. To do it without step recovery diodes is not easy. But so as you can tell, a very simple looking circuit schematically called diode, there's a zillion different ways you can make a diode. And if you start putting some extra leads in there, and you start making it into a silicon-controlled rectifier, or if you make it into a unit junction device, oh boy, you can have a lot of fun. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the word diode is far from a simple subject sometimes. You got it, John.
KC2WGB, yeah, it's sort of like radar, that very simple statement. 5,000 antennas is probably the same with radar and diodes. Wow, good, a lot of good stuff here. Also, when we're talking about UHF, VHF, and maybe even up, 10 gig band, stuff like that, so making antenna switching ports and multi-switches is a very simple thing to do with pin diodes, and they're readily available at those frequencies, correct? Back to you, Dick.
Yes, now, if you and I were building a phased array antenna, an antenna that we can electronically steer. By turning on and off certain elements across this, I got a great big bedspring of dipoles, so to speak. I got a, let me give an example. I've got an array of dipoles, four dipoles wide and four dipoles high. I've got 16 dipoles on this great big reflecting surface. And if I feed all the dipoles in a co-phase manner, I'm going to develop a beautiful normal wave. In other words, at right angles to that reflector plate, your main beam comes off of that 16-element antenna. And that's exactly the pattern I had with my 16 Yagis. Now, as you start turning on and off the power going to various dipoles, if you feed only one vertical string of four dipoles, as I did do on my four Yagis, you now are generating a pancake pattern, which is very wide in azimuth, but very narrow in elevation. Or, correspondingly, if I feed power to only one horizontal string of dipoles, I'm now making a pattern that's very narrow in azimuth, but very broad in elevation. So I can make a beaver tail beam-shaped antenna, or a beaver tail rotated 90 degrees, if you know what I mean. So, but depending on which elements you feed, what phase angle you feed them, and how much power you feed them, you've got a ridiculous amount of electronic tuning of that antenna. Let me drop. You can independently decide how wide is the beam width, how high is the beam width, how narrow is the pencil beam antenna if you feed all the antenna elements simultaneously. And if you now go the next step of phase shifting the signals you send to the antennas, you can electronically steer the signal to the left, to the right, up or down, without mechanically moving the antenna. The nice thing about electronic steering is you can do it in microseconds, whereas it takes you many seconds to mechanically steer the antenna. So if you can wave the beam of the antenna back and forth and up and down fast enough, you can do some very fancy electronic tracking. You may be looking at the echo from the cloud, the echo from an airplane or whatever. And if you can electronically steer that beam rapidly enough, you can get a lot of good information out of it. So diodes are one of the ways you could then, let me drop it. By turning on and off pin diodes that are going to the individual elements, I can determine whether or not they do or don't get a signal. And inside of the coax cable that goes to one of those dipoles, I can have a switching network made out of diodes, which is acting like a double-pole, double-throw switch, where I can now decide to throw in or throw out an extra length of cable going to the feed line going to that antenna. Therefore, I can create phase shift of the signal I'm sending to the antenna. And the fancy thing about a phased array antenna is it always fires in the direction of the delay. In other words, if I've got this array of dipoles, let's make the array of dipoles collinear. They're all parallel to the ground. They're all collinear, edge to edge, touching each other almost. And they're along a line from north to south. So that antenna will ordinarily fire to the east. It'll fire broadside, east and west. And by putting a reflector behind it, I can make it fire only to the east. Let me drop. So if I feed all the power, if I feed one quarter of the power to each of my four dipoles, and I feed it co-phase, and my string of dipoles are parallel to the ground, end-to-end, oriented north-south, I'm now firing a signal to the east. If I start delaying the signal on the more southern dipoles compared to the northern dipoles, I will be steering the beam not to the east, I'll be steering it toward the southeast. The beam always steers in the direction of the delay. So if the elements that are further to the south are more delayed, I will be steering the signal toward the south. You can see how magic that is. With the right kind of electronic circuits, you can wiggle that beam in space in microseconds. And there are times where, on case of fancy radars, for instance, I can give you a lot of good information. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Good information.
Yeah, they're fun to play with, and so are antennas. And that combination could be quite a powerful thing. And by the way, I just wanted to recommend that some of the youngsters that listen to us, if you get the magazine QST, there's a, let's see, that was October of 2015. A gentleman wrote an article called Learn by Fixing, and he goes into explaining about how you go and you can pick up some junk equipment at Hamfest or things like that, and even without a schematic, because you can draw that out, you can troubleshoot some of the simple stuff that you can buy for almost nothing, and it will teach you a lot about design and also about repairing. So I just wanted to bring that up. That's an excellent article, which a lot of people missed, I believe. You probably caught it, Dick. So it's almost a year ago. So just wanted to make that note. That's it from the mailbag. So back to you, Dick, and we'll go on to Paul, KC2, WGB.
Yeah, we amateurs, a guy I know pretty well who lives in my neighborhood has a 2-meter 440 rig in his automobile. And that exact model number and the exact brand name, a slightly unusual brand name, is not one of the big three, but it was one that it was a very good price. He had a problem with it where whenever he transmitted for more than 5 minutes on 450, the audio would go away on this FM transmitter, mobile rig. On 2 meters, it didn't do it, but on 450, it did it. After 5 minutes, it would always drop audio. He complained to the manufacturer, sent it back to them. They sent him a brand new rig. The brand new rig did it again. He sent that one back. He got a brand new one for the third time. It does the exact same thing. More than 5 minutes of transmitting on 450, the audio disappears. He asked me, should I throw the rig away? I said, absolutely not. Yeah, after three in a row, going back to the manufacturer, that's not working. We amateurs are not afraid to open up the cover. There may be a rumor out there that there's a scorpion inside with a year's supply of food. Don't believe it. To open up the cover of your rig, you're not violating the warranty. As long as you're a little bit careful, and in the case of a rig that's fed with 110 volts, be a little bit careful you don't give yourself a shock. Let me drop it. But opening up a rig and fixing it is nowhere near as difficult as you think. You'd be amazed how much extremely good troubleshooting you can do with nothing but a digital voltmeter. Whenever you open up the cover of a rig that is misbehaving, the very first thing you do is measure the power supply voltages. Every modern-day solid-state rig probably has a plus 13.8 volts that goes to the final stage. There's a plus 12 volts that goes to an oscillator, plus 9 volts that goes to a whole bunch of other circuits, a plus 5 volts that goes to the integrated circuits, and maybe there's a minus 5. And are all of those voltages very close to the right number coming out of the power supply when the rig is running? That's the first thing you test. The Kenwood TS711A, I got two of them, and one of them became dead some time ago, and just later on, earlier today, I decided to look at the power supply, and sure enough, I found out it wasn't putting out 13.8 volts. It's got a beautiful 110 volt or 220 volt transformer in it, the Kenwood TS711. It's one of the few rigs that's got 110 volt power supply built in. You can feed it 110 volts AC, 240 volts AC, or 13.8 volts DC. You choose whatever you want to feed it, and it runs. It's a base station rig, a little bit on the bulky side as far as mobile rigs are concerned. But it's a 2-meter all-mode rig with the cleanest frequency synthesizer I have ever seen. As I said, it moves in 10 hertz steps. Very clean synthesizer. Puts out an extremely clean single sideband signal. Only 30 watts of it, but you're going to put an afterburner on there. And it's got a knob on the front panel where you can continuously change the power output of that rig from 30 watts down to 1 watt, anywhere in between, by just rotating that knob for power output. Let me drop it. Almost everybody on 432, 1296, 2.3, 3.3, 5 gigs, 5.6 gigs, and 10 gigs, almost all of those people are using a transverter, and the transverter usually uses 2 meters as a tunable IF. So the fact that this rig puts out a thoroughly variable power output is extremely handy. because your transmitter might work correctly with 1.75 watts of drive power, if you know what I mean. And with that knob on the front panel, you could hit exactly that number with no grief at all. So don't worry about doing repairs. And with rare exception, you don't do any damage. Once you measure the power supply voltages, after that you do signal tracing techniques. You're looking at the signal coming in from the antenna as the first stage, amplifying it. With a fast modern-day oscilloscope, you can find that out. And so you move the oscilloscope one stage at a time downrange and watch the signal getting stronger and stronger in the receive mode. Or maybe you've got some tiny little signal squirter, which in some cases is nothing more than a one megacycle square wave generator. And it puts out a couple of milliwatts of signal. And through a 1K series resistor, you squirt that into various circuits of the receiver or the transmitter by just literally touching that circuit and seeing if the signal you're putting in, the square wave with all of its harmonics, and some of those harmonics are on the desired frequency, are they flowing through the rig? And with your oscilloscope, you see that signal getting stronger and stronger as you go downrange until you hit the bad stage, so to speak. So with a little bit of training, a little bit of information given to you by your buddies, troubleshooting the rig that you own is nowhere near as difficult as you think. Lots of people who have never done it are afraid to start. It's not rocket science, particularly when using a digital voltmeter to measure if the power supplies are putting out the right...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, the Eastern input just came back. I probably timed it out. That tirade, I think that was a result of something you asked me earlier, John. KC2WGB, you might have to repeat the question. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Well, I was just talking about that October 2015 article about fixing things. Excellent article, and you're absolutely right. The only thing you need a lot of when you're starting out, because you'll learn as you go, is the patience. Don't be in a hurry. Take your time and try to make sense out of some of the measurements. And, boy, that'll really put you in good stead, and you will accomplish a lot. Yeah, I agree. Don't be afraid. Open it up. Take a look. Poke around. And be careful. That's all. And have the patience to record some of the results. But good stuff. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Now, have you run out of mailbag subjects that you want to discuss tonight, John? We have more than enough time for another one if you want to. It's over to you.
Oh, no, that was the last one, Dick.
Okay. Then it's time we go over to the space report. And Paul's about to give us space report number 212, the magic number for the temperature of boiling water. I think it's 212, yes. 100 degrees centigrade, 212. So what has NASA and European Space Agency and the Oriental Space Agency and the Eastern Southern, let's see, ESO, European Southern Observatory? What have all these fancy space agencies been doing? And I hope that the James Webb Infrared Telescope, I hope it's still on schedule and going to be launched in, I think it's roughly September of 2018. And what a beautiful piece of hardware that is. I sure hope it goes well because I think it's roughly $2 billion worth. Let me drop it.
And 212 is only good at sea level.
Don, good point. You climb a high mountain and you start cooking your picnic food, and water doesn't boil at any near as high a temperature, so it takes a lot longer to cook those potatoes and your eggs because the water boils at a much lower temperature with less air pressure. But there are some people who will say, why in the world are we spending $1.8 billion or whatever it is for this particular spacecraft? Gee, we could be feeding a whole lot of people with that. It's a much better way of looking at the whole thing. You got to do a little bit of all this jazz. But that $1.8 billion spacecraft was built over a 10-year period. It was only $180 million per year. And you, the American citizen, by way of your taxes, let me drop this.
You got to go up a little higher, Dick.
Okay, I'll make it $2.2 billion. But it was over a 10-year period, so $220 million per year. And that works out to be something like 80 cents per every man, woman, and child in the United States. Are you willing to invest 80 cents per year to get that magic piece of spacecraft launched and operated? With any reasonable interest in science, I know the answer is yes. I don't know the exact number, but it's in that ballpark. Paul's going to correct me. WS2N, Space Report Number 212, J2RIW. Make sure, because that Eastern input is checking out on us, we got to be careful on our timing tonight, Paul. WS2N, J2RIW in the second half.
Okay, this is WS2N for the Space Report. Yeah, we're up to number 212. We've been keeping our records a lot longer if we go before that. That telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, is $8 billion. I know what you're thinking about. It's always in the news, the Curiosity, and the one that's going to be very similar to Curiosity, the 2020 rover. That's the $2 billion area, $2.1 billion price tag on each one. I believe the Tappan Zee Bridge is $2.5 billion to build, the new one that they're building. So things are very expensive, and you'll have to explain why they're worthwhile. I know, but I think you've got a whole explanation of why the cost of these telescopes are worthwhile and spacecraft. And we got to keep it short for these inputs. But like you said, 10-year time frame for $8 billion. So it's been spread out among different countries. European Space Agency is paying part of it, although most of their cost is in the launch of the spacecraft itself. They're launching it from Kourou, French Guiana in South America, with the Ariane 5 rocket. That's the heavy lift vehicle. And by the way, it won't be Ariane Space. Recently, a company just bought them up. Airbus Safran launches, ASL. They've been launching stuff for years, you know, building satellites and things. Now they're buying up most of the shares of that Ariane Space. I'd like to find out if Ariane Space is going to change their name. I'm going to find it hard to believe that they're going to do that. They've had it for so many years. So let me just drop this WS2N. Going off to another telescope topic, we started that to talk about it last week. The transiting exoplanet survey satellite, I think they called the two S's at the end. That orbit that we were talking about, the P2 or P divided by 2 orbit, in relation to the orbit of the moon. It's the first time they're going to use the P2 orbit. And I don't think I explained it. Well, I think I gave a half explanation on what we were talking about. The orbit is going to be like 13 and a half days. So roughly, exactly half the lunar orbit. Lunar orbit is about 27 days, so it's going to be a little over 13 days per orbit for the TESS telescope. And if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, the TESS is an offspring of Kepler-2. Kepler-2 is a planet-finding telescope, and that's what TESS is going to be as well. So that's going to be going out to the lunar orbit, the distance of the lunar orbit, and then coming back for perigee, the low point is 60, a little over 60,000 miles high, so way above the geosynchronous satellite height, which is roughly 23,000 miles high. So, of course, it won't be interfering with the geosynchronous satellites, but the most important thing it won't get interfered by is the Van Allen belt. Let me drop it. There's two belts, one at a lower altitude, I think some 600 miles high, and then there's a 6,000 or 8,000 mile high location of the Van Allen belt. Since this is going to be 60,000 miles at a low point and a quarter of a million miles at an apogee, they won't have that problem. But this relationship, it's you know, with the moon, they don't need the moon to change the orientation or speed or anything of the telescope. This way they could use the telescope with very little, if hardly any fuel at all, to keep it stable. And what will happen is when the moon is like 90 degrees in phase ahead of TESS will be, you know, at a high point in apogee, and then it'll come into a perigee at 60,000 miles, and by the time it gets back up to its apogee again, 13 and a half days later, the moon will travel one half the distance around its orbit. So again, it'll be 90 degrees away from the telescope. So that's the whole P2 thing. Let me drop it. So that's one thing I wanted to cover, and then I just wanted to bring up the tiles for the Orion spacecraft. The Orion spacecraft is still very much under construction. We won't see a launch probably until the end of 2018, and that one will be unmanned. That'll be the first launch of the SLS system, the Space Launch System, that will eventually launch people to the distance of the moon and eventually beyond that to Mars, and that's what they're building. But this one will be unmanned end of 2018. And it will go beyond the moon with a capsule and about 40,000 miles past the moon. And it'll be out there for the total mission will be about 3 weeks. And then we'll come back and re-enter the atmosphere. Now, coming back into the atmosphere, it'll be coming back probably around 25,000 miles per hour, instead of the normal 17,500 that a normal spacecraft from the International Space Station would be. This thing's going to come back at a much higher speed, so it needs to have a temperature capability of around 5,000 degrees. To withstand that, it's going to be using tiles and, you know, different but upgraded tiles, but tiles nevertheless that you had on the shuttle system. The good news here is you're not going to have as many tiles, and they're going to be there's going to be a lot more.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Locations on Orion, you're going to have a lot of common tiles where one could be put where the other one is. So that's going to reduce the cost. But I was reading about that recently, and they're up to that point where they're working on the tiles for Orion. A manned launch probably won't come until, I'm going to guess, 2020, 2021. Unfortunately, we've got a long way, I think, before that. The next launch I'm looking forward to, though, is the first launch out of Wallops Island, Virginia. It's been a long time. Let me drop it.
It's been a long time for a launch from Antares by an Antares rocket. It did have a launch, a couple of launches there and, recently, but nothing like this. This that big rocket. The Antares rocket will be launching the Cygnus spacecraft up to the International Space Station, and that will take place in August, which is about